Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It is February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. On our lineup on this Aloha Friday, we hear from the largest provider of artificial intelligence services for the U.S. military and federal government, why it's looking for top talent to accelerate technology solutions underway in Hawaii. It's to combat against the global threats in our region. We get the latest on a deadline for displaced fire victims. As of March, they will now have to pay rent that the federal government has picked up for the last year and a half, why some are asking for a break. We take in the scenery and hear about an open-air painting event returning to West Maui for the first time since the fires. And we celebrate an anniversary of our own. The Conversation turns 14. We flash back and bring you a Hanaho musical segment. Listening to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Is the United States losing ground in the space of artificial intelligence as our adversaries speed ahead? That's a conversation underway at the Honolulu Defense Forum happening in Waikiki this week. HPR brought you part of a keynote speech by Admiral Sam Paparo of the Indo-Pacific Command yesterday. He stressed the urgency to compete in the space to deter the threats made by other world leaders. Yesterday afternoon, we sat down with leaders from a major defense contractor, Booz Allen Hamilton. It has had a presence here on the island for nearly three decades. It employs 600 people, adding 200 just in the last year. The company has been priming the workforce pump, looking to develop talent. Leaders say it is the largest provider of AI services for the U.S. military, and it works closely with local universities, the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Pacific University, and Chaminade, to build a pipeline to entice Hawaii's best and brightest to enter the defense space. Heather Bush is a senior vice president in Europe based in Germany. She's transitioning to take over work here in the Hawaii division. We also talked to Ed Barnabas. He's a chief technologist for Booz Allen's regional headquarters in Honolulu. Bush starts us off about what we've learned with the war in Ukraine, how it can be applied here in the Pacific.
Right now, we're facing the biggest threat than we've seen really since World War II. So you have the convergence of threat from China to Russia to Iran and North Korea. And what that's doing is creating both a military and an economic bloc that is enabling them to operate in ways we've never seen before in the global world order. So, for example, because of their partnership, they can evade sanctions in a way they never have before. We see in Ukraine, North Korean soldiers on the ground for the first time. We see Russia exercising here in the Indo-Pacific with China. So again, we're seeing them cooperate in ways that is really creating a threat to our world order, and it demands action on a global scale. So that's really, when we look at this, you know, really military and economic bloc that is occurring, that's where industry can also come in and help. There are technologies that can be brought in. We can help to, you know, advance what's going on in the commercial side, bring it over to the defense, the Department of Defense and government, at a more rapid pace, and then scale it. Because really, the name of the game here is speed. We have to be obsessed with speed. And as we heard about last night, and as we heard about this morning from Admiral Paparo, really, the countries that can outpace China and this economic bloc, that's where the advantage is going to reign. And a big key to enabling that advantage is artificial intelligence. So artificial intelligence, as we heard again from Admiral Paparo this morning, it's not something that's just nice to have. It's an absolute strategic imperative for our national security. So that's where we need to look at how we can scale that and implement it within, you know, the security environment at a rapid pace. And we need to do so quickly and in a cost-effective manner. You know, not too long ago, just a couple of weeks ago, we saw DeepSeek, right, create an LLM at a fraction of the price and a fraction of the time that the United States has typically been able to do that. So the U.S. and our allies and partners, we absolutely cannot afford to be second. We have to prioritize this, and we have to move forward rapidly.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely got that sense of urgency with the Admiral's speech earlier. So what is it that we're doing and what more can we do in the area of AI?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of things we can do in the area of AI, and I'm actually going to turn it over to my colleague, Ed, who's our Chief Technology Officer here in the Indo-Pacific, to talk about it.
As Heather was saying, just with this convergence of threat in the region, there's one thing that Admiral Paparo said this morning, which was there's no choice but to compete in the AI space because our adversaries are investing heavily in the technology. They are moving at a pace that is hard to keep up with. And if we ever get into conflict, it's less going to be about old warfare, which is bullets, and it's going to be more about digital warfare. And so the more that we're making sure that we're not just keeping pace, but outpacing our adversaries is really important. And I think because we have such a historical, strong military, but one that has to modernize, right? That doesn't happen overnight. However, we don't really have a lot of time, right? There's a lot of tension in the region about what's happening in the island chains, what's happening around Taiwan. And so the urgency to innovate and the urgency to adopt AI is at a pace that I don't think that we have operated before within the military, but it's completely necessary. And I think that was underlined and reiterated by many of the leaders here this week. And it's something that us as Booz Allen deeply feel. We see it. We've been here in the region for close to 30 years. We deeply understand the ongoing threat that's evolved over time. And we deeply understand what we need to do now. And then being in a position of being a trusted partner here on island and in the region that understands the mission, it gives us a great opportunity.
And you've recently expanded your office and we're really doing things in the workforce areas because we need to be somewhere else in warp speed time.
Right. Well, there's many ways to look at it. One is that the mission needs really talented, smart people, right? That's one. And we can't have enough of those people. With the urgency for us to deliver capabilities, we don't necessarily have time to source talent from all over. And with the defense spending that's continuously being shifted to the Pacific, there's an urgency there. Looking at it from a local perspective, it's a lot of opportunity for jobs. Right. And a lot of those jobs, because they are shifting towards technology, is another great opportunity for young students in high school and college to start looking at the defense and national security space as a place where they can actually get high paying technical jobs where they don't have to go to the mainland and they can stay here and be with their families and not feel forced to leave, but doing meaningful work for the government. So it provides, in one instance, this urgency is a real threat. It's very serious. We heard that over. But it also provides, I think, an opportunity for Hawaiians, not just for the workforce, but to help diversify the economy and to do more technical adoption.
And so how are you seeing this transition then as you come over? Because at this conference, there are a number of European countries. I think it's the largest contingent that we've seen just because of the political climate.
Yeah. So what I'm seeing with this transition is an acknowledgement from European partners and others in different geographic regions of the fact that this is a global threat, you know, and with the Euro-Atlantic in particular, they share a border, a seam with the Indo-Pacific, right? So what happens in the Indo-Pacific can spill over into the Euro-Atlantic and threaten world order. So there is a need to come together and outpace as a united front to outpace this military and economic block that's been created by our adversaries. And we can only do that together.
I don't know if there's anything you can say or want to say about just the changes that have been happening, because there are some that worry that the new administration is moving also with great speed, but that a lot of guardrails are being removed. And that makes us weaker on the world stage.
What I would say is with the pace at which this administration is moving, we're seeing them lean in towards tech and towards innovation. And that creates opportunity because we need tech innovation and mission to be at the nexus together so that you can use tech as a strategic differentiator here on that global stage. So they're creating a way for that to happen at speed and for industries to be tapped into and for that advanced technology to be used, just like we're able to bring that at Booz Allen as an advanced technology company into this environment to help keep our world a safer place.
You know, I was thinking the Admiral talked about the bureaucracy that we need to cut through because we need to be at the end of the runway. And we're not there, and we can't afford to wait as long as we have in the past. I don't know, anything you want to just add about that?
Yeah, I mean, I know they talked last night about needing to be able to adopt at the rate of that the warfighter needs, not at the rate that committees operate. So that was some of the discussion last night, again, pointing to the importance of speed and scale to be able to outpace the adversaries that are currently in place. So, you know, from that discussion, there does need to be some reform in that way based on what was said last night.
Yeah, it's a fair question.
Yeah.
But I think to Heather's point, the rate at which technology evolves, the government has always found it difficult to match the acquisition cycle, the procurement cycle, policies and procedures in order just to keep up at the rate of technology. So I don't think that's a new problem that has been trying to solve by the defense industrial base and along with the government. But I think it's just more heightened based on the threat that we see in the region. So it's putting more of a spotlight on, you know, if you went to a conference like this 10 years ago, it would be, hey, we need to look at technology. That's something we need to consider. Now, when you come here, it's like, it's the forefront of everyone's conversation. So now that it's become such a critical path to success, you have to say, do we have all of the supporting mechanisms that can help it move fast? So I think, yes, there is a lot of change happening right now, but the questions in terms of, or the answers that we need to find are not necessarily new. There's just more urgency around them. And I think with innovation, it's always, regardless of what industry, regardless of what time, it's always a balance of risk versus speed, right? So we heard Admiral Papar use the word good enough. I don't know if we caught that, but there has to be solutions that we have to be okay with good enough, but we always have to make sure that we're managing risk along that. And that's just a responsible thing to do. But we also can't sacrifice movement, right? Because we need to make sure that everything is accounted for, but we also have to balance the risk as well. So I think it's just something that has to be done in an incremental way and a responsible way, but it's still the underlying word which we're hearing in every breakout is around speed because of the, and it's not speed for the sake of speed's sake. It's the sake of keeping the Indo-Pacific free and open.
Right, because of the risk and the threat.
Yeah, and I'll just add one thing that we've been talking about at Booz Allen when we talk about this current, you know, geopolitical environment is outcomes-based acquisition. And what we mean by that is leveraging industry in a way that is measured based on outcomes. That outcome can be measurement of effects in the information environment. That outcome could be lives saved. That outcome could be better strategic positioning. The outcome could be faster integration of prototypes and technology. But that is another way to speed up the way that things are occurring right now for national security.
Any other final thoughts, just as you prepare to make this transition to take over here?
Yeah, I mean, the threat is great, no doubt about it. With that, you know, there's a real opportunity for us to come together as a united front, certainly, you know, as part of the United States, but for industry to play a part as well. And I'm looking forward personally, you know, I was over in Germany for over a decade, and our team was leaning in advance of, during, and after the fight of Ukraine. We were on the watch floor watching those first bombs drop in February 3 years ago. So there's a lot of experience that can now be imported into this region based on lessons learned in Europe to help with a mission in this geopolitical environment.
That was Heather Bush and Ed Barnabas of Booz Allen Hamilton, an advanced technology company with offices here in Hawaii. The Pacific Forum Defense Conference wraps up today, but we'll continue to feature prominent attendees next week.
How's your love life? Dating apps like Tinder, Bumble, and Hinge have revolutionized how people meet. But is their heyday over? Some say that dating apps have killed romance and trapped us in this endless, lonely loop of swipes, while others argue the apps open doors and lead to happy marriages and babies. This week on Open to Debate, we tackle the question, is it time to break up with dating apps? I'm Naima Raza.
Beginning Monday morning at 11. I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we catch up with the Hawaii Venture Capital Association and learn about their annual Entrepreneurs Award. We'll hear from these rising entrepreneurs and learn more about their startup success stories throughout 2024. That's today at 6:30 on Bite Marks Cafe.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okauai, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omaui, okaholabe, ohawai.
For today's Backyard Quiz, we celebrate the 14th anniversary of our show by asking you to identify one of the guests on our very first broadcast. He's a familiar name in the world of surfing, known for his shaping skills and custom boards. He grew up in Playa del Rey, California, where he learned to make longboards. In 1968, he received a planer for his birthday, and he would go on to use that same tool for decades, shaping more than 100,000 boards with it. His mentors include famous board shapers like Phil Becker and Tom Oberlin. By 1972, he was shaping boards on the North Shore of Oahu, where his work quickly became a favorite of big wave riders. The founders of Local Motion helped elevate his reputation by the 1980s, and his work was sought by world champions like Mark Richards and Tom Carroll. By the 1990s, he was selling his work internationally, and his boards are now available in 31 countries. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this legendary North Shore surfboard shaper who appeared on the very first episode of The Conversation? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HBR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for young farmers seeking a future in agriculture, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Well, the clock is ticking on displaced wildfire families now in housing on Maui, where FEMA has been paying the rent. That will end on March 1st. Here with an update on where things stand is HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
It's been about a year and a half since, you know, these fires, and, you know, the families have been getting some, you know, federal assistance, and what, some are asking for a break with this deadline?
Yeah, so starting March 1st, as you said, fire survivors in FEMA's Direct Housing Assistance Program will have to start paying rent. So Direct Housing is, FEMA has been paying individual landlords rent to be able to house fire survivors. FEMA has also built special housing for some fire survivors. And so all of the folks that are still in that FEMA-provided housing need to start paying rent 18 months after a disaster is declared. And so this is a federal law. The rent paid by fire survivors does go directly back to FEMA's disaster relief fund. And so FEMA is still paying the landlords under a separate agreement. But the amounts that fire survivors have to start paying on March 1st is based on HUD fair market rent, as well as the survivor's ability to pay. And so FEMA is saying that they won't have to pay more than 30% of the household's income. But many people are telling me they can't afford to pay it. And the letters that they've been getting for rent are right at the top of those allowable charges. FEMA says that of the about 1,100 households currently in this program, over 600 appeals have been filed. And so if people aren't able to pay the rent, they can file an appeal. 34 of those are still pending. And so a lot of folks I talk to are actually in that category. They're still waiting in limbo to hear whether they will be allowed to pay a lower rate. The rent that is being charged, a big point of confusion among many folks I've spoken with is, you know, that line between the rent that fire survivors are paying to FEMA separate from, it's a little confusing, separate from the rent that FEMA is paying directly to those landlords. And so there won't be a sudden change in the housing that people will be eligible for. They'll be staying in the housing, for the most part, that they have been housed in up until this point. But this is a big challenge for people to suddenly have to start paying rent. And so Charles Nahale is a Lahaina fire survivor that I've stayed in touch with over the past year or so, since he was living in hotels and condos, moving, you know, six or seven different times. FEMA placed him in an apartment in West Maui last June. Nahale's FEMA rent appeal is one of those still pending. And here's what the process has been like for him.
The amount they were asking me, I just have a one bedroom, was absurd. So I was very disheartened by that. The amount that they asked me to start to pay them was way more than I can afford. I sent a appeal letter. It was an option that one had, if is to send an appeal letter. So I did, and attached to it supporting documents to help to make my case stronger. I'm waiting for a decision, and this is I've spoken with FEMA. Gosh, since I sent my initial appeal letter, maybe close to 10 times, I think, to kind of ask to get some insight of where they are on the decision. I'm pleased, you know, it's still pending, which gives me hope. But the other side of the coin is that I am sort of in limbo waiting, hoping for a good response.
Do we know how much he's being asked to pay?
So it's over $700. The amounts that are fair market rent, again, based on HUD fair market rent for the Maui location, a one bedroom that he's in, the maximum is $1,762. A two bedroom is $2,300. Three bedroom is a little over $3,000. So these are pretty large amounts that people have to start paying. You know, FEMA says they gave people 90-day notices, 60-day notices, 30-day notices. And, you know, again, more than half of those people did file appeals on these amounts because, you know, many people haven't been able to go back to work. Many people are still really struggling, you know, with daily life since the fire. And so having to pay these amounts without, you know, a steady income in many cases is just a really big challenge. And so Nahale shared how frustrating just the FEMA process in general has been.
I called again yesterday. I called this person again because I hadn't heard anything. Now the person tells me she's not my caseworker anymore. There's somebody else on my case now who I don't know. I don't know this person, the new person's name or phone number. So this is the kind of bureaucracy that we are dealing with. Gosh, you know, I guess boil it down to the core, it's money driven. You talk to them, you don't feel any sense of compassion or understanding of what we're going through, what we're having to live through. A very cold, a very matter of fact. So it's an ongoing problem still. Can you believe after all this time, we're still dealing with housing issues.
So what does FEMA have to say, you know, about resolving these 30-some appeals?
Well, they say they're working through them as quickly as they can. They say that they're hoping to get back to everybody, you know, by that March 1st date. But here's a letter that a fire survivor household received. So this is from FEMA. If you choose to stay in the FEMA unit after February 10th, you must pay, and for this family, it was the three-bedroom rate, $3,103 each month for as long as you stay in the FEMA unit. FEMA will send you a monthly bill, explains how much you owe. If you can't afford this amount, you may qualify for a lower rent based on what you're able to pay. If you don't want to pay the monthly rent, FEMA may end your eligibility to stay in the FEMA unit and start the debt collection process. If you plan to move out and don't want to pay the monthly rent, you must move out of the FEMA unit by February 10th. And so this has just been a really traumatic process for people, you know, receiving that wording and, you know, hey, I can't pay it, but do I have to move out? I mean, it's been a really big change for people
trying to navigate. They're scared about that. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been talking with HBR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Chaminade University. Its online doctorate of education in organizational leadership empowers leaders to inspire their teams, effect change, and elevate their organization. Learn more at chaminade.edu.
On the next Science Friday, we're headed to the North and South Poles to marvel at the ice and the life it sustains. Plus, love is in the air and in the lab.
Our first conversation was about high-altitude cerebral edema, which made him find me irresistible.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. On view now, Alan Bromley, At the Edge of Forever, mixed-media print-based works that explore themes such as memory, loss, and the environment. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Four painters from around the world will gather tomorrow morning at Hana Ka'o'o Beach Park in Lahaina to paint what they see. The paint out marks the kickoff of the week-long Paint Maui Invitational. It's the first time the plein air painting event has been held since the 2023 Maui wildfires. Lin Shu is the organizer of the event and the owner of Village Galleries Maui, which was destroyed in the fires. She took a break from setting up a temporary gallery in the Lahaina Cannery to speak with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about her business recovery and the joy of open-air painting.
Well, I opened the gallery in 1970, so I had it for 53 years. And I've had several locations, but that location, I was in it since 78. So it meant an awful lot to the whole community. And also, it was part of the historic corner at Dickinson and Front Street. So people consider it a historic building, even though it really wasn't, but it had been there so long. And so all the beautiful artwork that was in there, I had probably 63 artists that I handle. And as I think back on the walls, I can picture them in my mind, all the wonderful pieces that were destroyed in the fire. Yeah, it was horrible.
At what point did you think about rebuilding? Because I can imagine right after, it would have been such a tough thought starting up again after something like the fires.
Well, I thought my house was gone too, but then later, a few days later, I found out that it was not gone, that I still have my house. But in the meantime, I had flown to Portland, Oregon to be near my daughter. So I was there from August to January. And during that time, it was quite a bad weather in Oregon. And I sat there day after day thinking, I got to get back home. I got to get back to Maui. And then the artist started calling me and my clients started calling and saying, are you coming back? When are you going to do? Are you going to start over? And I said, darn right I am. That's my focus now, is to get back and get going and get the gallery open again.
And I'm sure that wasn't easy, but how long did that take you and what did that look like?
I haven't got my space yet. I mean, I have the space and I have the lease for the space, but they're building the building now, so I'm not in there yet, but hopefully it'll be close and I can get in there sometime in March. And by April, hopefully, I will be able to hang some paintings in there and be back in business.
But one of the things that is coming back is going to be Paint Maui 2025, the plein air invitational. So before we talk about what this year's event will look like, give us a sense of the history and the kinds of things that you featured in past years.
Yes, it was, I think we've been doing it now 18 years. And the first year, one of my friends, an artist named Ronaldo Machado, he came to me along with Theo Morrison, who is the head of the Restoration Foundation. He's saying, let's start a plein air show. And I said, okay, well, how do we do that? And so we started inviting artists, and the word got out, and we had too many artists. We had to even turn people away because it was just everybody wanted to come to Maui, and everybody wanted to express themselves in their artwork. And so it's grown fast, and this year, when we put the word out that we were going to start it up again, we had a deluge of artists wanting to participate. But it's an invitational, so we had to look carefully through each person that put their, you know, wanted to be invited. And so we chose 24 artists who will be featured this year.
And there's so many different aspects, right, in terms of workshops and lessons and sales. But what are the through lines? How would you summarize the event?
It's a gathering of artists of like mind. They're all plein air painters. That means they paint outdoors, capturing this light as the light changes. Usually the painting, you can't really paint it for more than 3 hours because the light changes and then the painting is different. So there's a part of plein air that is something that you have to be ready to capture it and then and paint and know your craft, I should say. It's an interesting type of painting, and it's really is wonderful for Maui because the beauty here is captured in that moment that the artist can set up and paint it in a couple hours and catch it.
Yeah. So talk about some of the paintings that have come out of this event. I know I saw something about daily paintouts at iconic locations. So what locations are artists looking to capture and highlight?
I think they do their kickoff paint out at Canoe Beach this year. It's kind of a favorite place for the artists because it's all the beautiful, colorful canoes all pulled up on shore. Plus, they have a seascape if they want, and if they want to turn around, they can paint the mountains. So it's got a 360-degree turn for any kind of subject matter that you want to do there. And also, it's easy to get to, and the artists like to be there. And then we're going to do one up at Fleming Beach, and we also do the children's art show. Well, it's more a class at the Royal Lahaina Hotel. 40 children are invited to come and paint for a whole morning. We sponsor that, and the Rotary Club is also a sponsor. And the artists have also been invited to paint at the old Lahaina Luau on Front Street. And they're all excited to do that because it's going to be kind of a dusk, and maybe the sunset will be happening, and that light will be different, and they can set up in a couple hours, maybe capture a little bit of that, and maybe a dancer dancing, you know. They're all excited.
Yeah,
we try to set up things that really spark them, you know, either have someone posing for them or a special area that, because they have 24 artists painting, so you want to have something that they all can enjoy.
Yeah, and I think there's something really special, too, about paintings in general when we think about West Maui, because that artwork were some of folks' only memories or remaining memories of certain places. So is that the kind of intention, or do you think that feeling is present in this year's festival?
I think the artists are coming back trying to, if they've been here before or even if they haven't, they want to capture the beauty of this island and the aloha, I should say, because the event has been open arms from everybody. Everybody's been helping to make it work. And I think the fire just makes people want to show off Maui even more because it's, they feel such an attachment to the island that the fire has kind of brought out the love, because there's so many places that they can't paint anymore because of the fire. They have to find new vistas to paint, and they're all looking forward to that. So it's going to be great.
What are some of the basics of plein air painting? I mean, we have the definition of painting what you see and not waiting too long for the light to change. And so if folks want to incorporate some of the practice of plein air painting, how would they do that?
Well, I think if you're a plein air painter, you mostly are. Most of them don't do that much in their studios. It's kind of a lifestyle to be a painter, and learning from each other. I think that's a camaraderie, and that's what makes it so much fun. Is it's a lonely life when you're working in a studio because you're all by yourself for hours. This way, you get to go out and be with other artists and talk about how you learn more craft and who painted what when, and it makes it a lot more fun.
Just as someone who's not an artist myself, I'm thinking about just a total amateur trying to approach this, and you're staring at a blank canvas and you have beautiful scenery in front of you. Where do you start?
Yeah, where do you start? You start by hopefully some background in drawing, and you lay out your canvas, hopefully quickly, and get your color moving over the surface. And everybody has their own style, and that's what makes plein air so great too. You can paint the same subject and you'll have 15 people painting it, and they'll look so different because each one has their own unique way of portraying what they see. It's exciting.
Are there any other highlights of the week that you want to mention, that you want listeners to know about?
Yes, we're having the gala on Friday. That's, of course, the premier spotlight for the artists. They will bring in their artwork the day before on Thursday, and I'll start hanging it. And then if they can't do that, they'll bring it in early on Friday, which some artists can't get ready fast enough. And then I'll start hanging it, and by 4 o'clock, I'll have it all hung, and we'll have a really nice layout of food for everyone, and we have it blessed, and hopefully a lot of people will come and enjoy with us, and meet the artists, get to know a little bit more about plein air painting, and be able to take a beautiful memory home with them when they leave.
And that's the beauty of it too, right? If the artist isn't ready, they could just go outside and paint something up in a couple hours.
That's happened.
Is there anything else that you want to add about the upcoming Invitational, or, I mean, your own story?
This whole Invitational is free to the public. So the opening, everyone is welcome to all the functions and all the events. And if you see an artist on the street painting, you'll know that they're one of our group, and give them support and watch them and tell them their painting is gorgeous.
Yeah, I love that positive reinforcement. Well, thank you so much, Lynn. I really appreciate your taking the time.
Oh, gosh, it's been a joy.
Now, that was Lynn Shu, the owner of Village Galleries Maui and the organizer of the 18th Paint Maui Invitational. The plein air painters from around the world will bring their week's worth of paintings to show at the Lahaina Cannery Mall beginning Friday, February 21st. We'll have links to learn more about the event on our website after the show.
When you support HPR, you support locally produced programs featuring locally produced music, including Kani Kapila Sunday.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Kani Kapila Sunday. I'm Kaylee Iloma, and I'm so happy to be with you again on a Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. to offer you great Hawaiian music from all periods.
Hawaii Kula Ivi.
Aloha nui kako. You are tuned in to member-supported Hawaii Public Radio 1's Hawaii Kula Ivi. Ovo no ke yo, DJ Mermaid, Paige Okamura.
And Mauka Tumakai.
This is Mauka Tumakai. I'm your host, Roger Bong.
Your support brings the music of Hawaii to the world. Support Hawaiian and local music programs on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thank you.
And now it's time to carve the wave and reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we asked you to name a famous surfboard shaper who also happened to be a guest on our first ever broadcast. In 2020, this mystery surfboard carver was honored as an icon of foam at the Boardroom International Surfboard Show. And did you know that the planer he received for his birthday in 1968 went missing decades later? It was lost on a flight from Spain to Paris, but he hasn't given up hope that it will turn up one day. Perhaps the board he is most famous for, though, is the Rawson Gun, a board that's become synonymous with Oahu's North Shore and Sunset Beach, which he claimed as his home base for decades. And he's still at it today. After taking a five-year break from his work to travel the world, he moved his board-making operation to San Diego, where he's perfected his approach to alternative board designs, like the Impala and the Sniper designs, which are popular here in Hawaii and beyond. So our mystery manufacturer and a guest on our first show was Pat Rawson. And the winner of our show today, he got the right answer. Dale Hope of Waimea on the Big Island says he knew the answer because he knows Rawson personally. I love when that happens. That's our quiz for today. If you have one to share, send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Did you miss the latest edition of The Conversation or Fresh Air? Sometimes you just can't listen to your favorite show when it airs on HBR, but you can listen to it on demand with our free mobile app for your iPhone, iPad, or Android. It even integrates with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, so you can listen hands-free in your car. Get the HBR app in the App Store or on Google Play.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits offering workforce housing solutions for young Kama'aina training to become farmers, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation, NereidHawaii.com.
For our final segment on this Aloha Friday, we tip our hats to love. We happen to be celebrating an anniversary of our own. 14 years ago today, HPR debuted its talk show, The Conversation. So it's our golden birthday, and we thought we'd end with a segment from our fourth year of existence. In 2015, we hosted vocalist Willow Chang and musician Sunny Silva from Hot Club of Hulaville. Fun fact, Silva was an inaugural guest on the first ever episode of The Conversation. In the segment, former host Chris Vandercook sat down with the duo to talk about love songs. Chang and Silva perform a mini concert for us in Control Room 7. Here's Vandercook.
The Great American Songbook has about 300 songs in it with love in the title. So choosing a repertoire for a romantic Valentine's Day dinner performance becomes more a matter of what to leave out than what to include. It's a challenge, but Willow Chang and her accompanist, guitarist Sunny Silva, are more than equal to it. They're here in the studio to perform for us, and I'm going to ask Willow how she comes up with her choices of material. Good morning, Willow.
Good morning. So nice to be here.
It's good to have you here.
It's always a delight, always a pleasure. Thank you. To answer your question, you know, I think what you said was so apt because you talked about what songs do you have to leave out? I mean, at some point you have to decide and trim the fat. And
yeah,
there are songs that I certainly love and I will go to bat and always want to include. One of them is Someone to Watch Over Me. Enjoy I'll Be Seeing You. And then there are songs that are musically challenging, like Desafinado, Begin the Begin, Night and Day. If you have any vocalists or instrumentalists out there, the form is not necessarily strophic or simple, so they're fun. You want to make sure that you have a balance between things that are emotive, but things that are fun for the musicians. So, yeah.
And there's songs, you mentioned Begin the Begin, mm-hmm. Stardust is another one that sort of structurally goes on and on rather than repeating a few sections.
So. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think the idea of love and what it encompasses is so infinite. So you can have songs that kind of lean on the side of happy-go-lucky, like Blue Skies,
yeah.
Or you can have songs that are a little despondent, like Lush Life. I mean, ultimately, it's still a love song, but it's about the aftermath of something that's maybe fallen apart. So, yeah. You know, you have to calibrate what kind of mood do you want to create. You can't just have everybody crying in their beer.
No, but at the same time, there's something about those poignant songs. I mean, My Funny Valentine itself is a...
Absolutely. And we also enjoy doing the catalog of Jobim. And one of the hallmarks of a lot of Brazilian music is that it has that element of saudade. So that feeling of longing or even sadness for things that once were or things that can no longer be, that always resonates. And, you know, there's a lot of intricacies and subtleties to that music. And I think that's why this catalog of music, even though that's not necessarily American, it resonates with people because it endures. People can relate to the emotive qualities, and there's a sensitivity to this music. It's so beautiful.
Well, there's also that thing that you, when you're programming songs of, you know, you can have a sad and wistful love song, but then you, unless you want to go down that road entirely, you can sort of then turn around and do I Want to Be Happy or some song like that.
Or you just bust out the kazoo.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves with that. Right? You know, I'm thinking of a song like They Say It's Wonderful, where you can play it as a straight out, love is wonderful, or a kind of a sad, am I really sure that love is all that wonderful? That comes down to the delivery, doesn't it?
It does. And I'd also say, a lot of these music, the songsmiths, the wordsmiths of the writing, whether you have Cole Porter or even the works of Gershwin, you know, if you hear just the title, How Long Has This Been Going On, and it's often referred to as Salty Tears, you might think that it's a sad song, but there's a revelatory quality to them because it's not saying it's sad, but it's like, oh my goodness, love is so wonderful. How could I have not known about it? Yeah. So there's complexity to that, which you don't necessarily find in a lot of contemporary music that's played on the radio. I mean, you can go through a whole song and they never once say, oh, baby.
Yeah, I know. Remarkable, but it's true.
It is.
Well, Willow, let's have you and Sonny do, you picked out a song for us, so let's have you do that.
We did. And this is a song that most people recognize. And you know, sometimes you just got to play music that people know.
This would be a good time.
Yeah. L is for the way you look at me. Oh. It's for the only one I see. V is very, very extraordinary. E, it's even more than anyone that you adore can love. It's all that I can give to you. Love, it's more than just a game for two. Two and love can make it. Take my heart, but please don't break it. Love was made for me and you. V is very, very extraordinary. It's even more than anyone that you adore can love. It's all that I can give to you. Love, it's more than just a game for two. Two and love can make it. Take my heart, but please don't break it, love. was made for me and you. Yes, love was made for me and you. Love was made for me and you.
And that was vocalist Willow Chang, accompanied by Sonny Silva on guitar. It was a Hana Ho of an interview and performance from 2015 when they sat down with the former host of The Conversation, Chris Vandercook. And as an extra treat to play us out here, here's HPR's own board operator and vocalist Kelsey Armstrong performing with Hot Club of Hooligville. It was last year as part of our Atherton Jazz Performance Series. Take it away, Kelsey.
Lullaby of Berlin, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my woodland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Have you ever heard two spotty doves bill and coo in the love? That's the kind of magic music we make with all in.
We have talented staff here. Well, that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we're taking the holiday on Monday, but we plan to continue to have conversations around national security. Call our talkback line, leave your comments, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Heron-Pote and Tori DeJournay. Backyard Quiz theme is thanks to John DeMello. Our current theme music, courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday, or join us on Tuesday. Pick up the conversation.